A strange spiralling white light was spotted in the early morning sky over Sydney, with even sceptical witnesses wondering if it was a UFO.
They were last seen on the beach with a tall man, and that's the best description police have ever had of him.
More than 17 years after Harold Holt disappeared into raging surf at Cheviot Beach, his widow has finally revealed his last romantic words.
Shocking, terrifying, mesmerising. That's the way a number of Australians have described their alleged encounter with the Yowie.
It's time for the Weird Crap in Australia podcast.
Welcome to the Weird Crap in Australia podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Soule. Joining me in the co-host seat, of course, is a researcher extraordinaire herself, Holly Soule.
And Joker in the background.
And Joker in the goddamn background. You know, just to give you a little bit of an insight into how we produce these, we do it late at night. That way we can prevent a lot of ambient noise. And Joker will be our biggest cat. He's a little male, long-haired mix of whatever.
He's a medium-haired bitzer.
He decides to be quiet the entire evening. And then as soon as we start speaking, three things happen. He starts yelling at us. Then he'll go and use the litter box. Of course, we edit that out for you guys. And then he'll chase the other cat up and down the house.
And then they'll have a play fight, so you might hear the background.
Drives us insane. It's like children. It's putting us off having a child.
We already have two. Fur babies. That's why fur babies was coined.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we're about to embark on a new two-parter, and it is also about a serial killer, the serial killer known only as the Granny Killer. The Granny Killer operated for a very short period between 1989 and 1990 and has pretty much ticked off every single box that a serial killer could. We're going to have a lot of interesting discussions, especially in part two. But for part one, let us take you into this harrowing nightmare where the peoples of the North Shore in Sydney, specifically the elderly, were kept in terror by one single man.
On January 11, 1989, Margaret Todd Hunter was heading down Hale Road, Mossman, when a 32-year-old young man punched her in the face and ran away with her purse, the contents of which were just over $200 in cash. Police were unable to ascribe the crime of Mrs. Todd Hunter's attack to any suspects, and it was recorded as a mugging. No arrest was ever made, and the case went cold.
He parked his car, and after he was satisfied no one was looking, he punched the unsuspecting victim in the face with a swinging right hook and relieved her of her handbag containing $209. As he fled down the street with her bag, Mrs. Todd Hunter called out, "You rotten bugger!"
Gotta do it in an old lady voice.
"You rotten bugger!"
That's better.
Is that better?
That's better. That came from Paul Kidd's Never to Be Released.
"He's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy."
Pretty much. 3 months after the senseless attack, on March 1st at about 3:50 p.m., 82-year-old Gwendolyn Mitchell Hill was returning from her routine shopping trip. Mitchell Hill was carrying her groceries as she walked down the main road. Now, she was unaware that a true monster was stalking her from the distance. Mrs. Mitchell Hill entered the front foyer of her Military Road apartment, and as she went to open the door, someone hit the woman over the back of the head. When she went down, he continued hitting her, breaking ribs and shattering her skull. The perpetrator quickly fled the scene with the old woman's purse, containing about $100.
Gwendolyn Louise Mitchell Hill was found in a semi-conscious condition outside a block of home units situated at 699 Military Road. Mossman, suffering from a severe head injury, later died in hospital. It was later ascertained that she had been the victim of a vicious assault.
And that came from the Government Gazette of the State of New South Wales.
So one of the interesting things here is we're obviously alluding that those two incidents are connected. Now, most serial killers have what's called a ramping up period.
Escalation period.
You know, they start to escalate. They go from petty crimes like theft, break and enter, Serial killers like to break into people's homes and mess around with their things, especially in the early days. The reason they do that is it's when it comes to serial killing, a lot of it is power control.
Mm-hmm.
Coming into your sacred space, mucking around with your items, taking some of them, reliving that moment.
Moving a drawer just like 2 inches to the left so you're constantly stubbing your toe on it. You know that he's been there.
Yeah, it's all about interfering with someone's sacred space,
mm-hmm.
you know. And this is one thing that we see quite often, but we don't usually go straight from robbery to murder.
Yeah.
Like that is a very quick leap, which almost makes me think that the previous incident could have very well been murder, if not for the fact that the individual was probably just starting to get out there.
On the other hand, there's the idea that this one wasn't meant to be a murder.
I mean, that is true too. I mean, when you look at interesting serial killers like John Wayne Gacy, for example, his first kill was an accident.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was a rapist by that stage, but his actual first kill was an accident. A kid that he had picked up, a young prostitute, had decided to actually cook him breakfast. When John Wayne Gacy woke up, he saw the kid holding the knife, right? Didn't realize that the kid had made him breakfast. And so he attacked the kid, stabbed him, and achieved sexual climax at that point. The act of murder gave him a sexual gratification that he hadn't experienced before. It was an accident.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always there, and it's still, it's like that one little incident that was enough to, you know, open him up to perpetrating all these terrible crimes. So it is interesting that this individual, like you suggest, Holly, the theory may be that he attacked the woman, she died, but maybe that wasn't the intention, but at that point the spark had sort of been lit.
She died after he left the scene. That's what gives me that idea.
You know, maybe reading about it after the fact, you know, because most killers or, you know, most thieves, most criminals, they often try and find their own press. They often enjoy it. And maybe he read about his crime. Who knows?
Quite possibly. Two schoolboys returning home found the woman and called for help, but some sources report she died in the foyer before emergency services could reach her. There were no eyewitnesses to the attack and nothing to really link this attack to that on Mrs. Todhunter a few months before, except the bag snatching, which is sadly a common experience. Neighbours, thinking the old woman had merely fallen, cleaned the crime scene before police could gather evidence. Once again, this was put down as a mugging gone wrong.
And unfortunately, a trend is about to be set where it comes to mucking around with crime scenes. This happens a lot more often than people think, and the nature of your neighbors, your friends, your family, they come into your home, a crime has happened, you're all over the place in this fictitious scenario, you're the victim, and their first instinct is to clean everything up.
Or to grab the jewels or to hide something or something like that.
Do not touch a crime scene in any way, shape, or form. Number one, you could accidentally implicate yourself. So that's the big one. Number two, you can and will destroy any potential evidence. It's really, really bad.
You can also misdirect the police. Like I said, if you take something like the family jewels out of the safe, it then makes it look like a robbery gone wrong instead of a targeted attack.
Some of the most infamous mysteries, like the murder of JonBenet Ramsey, a bunch of people came in and cleaned the whole house top to bottom with cleaning products.
That's
on
a
the
smart
day.
Thing to do. Yeah, that's definitely not a cover-up.
O.J. Simpson, that entire crime scene was completely washed, doors were replaced, and fingerprints were removed.
That's not a conspiracy.
It was because Los Angeles has cleanliness ordinances, so it had to be done the next day. So, yeah, crime scene destruction is one of the worst things you can do. The pioneers of detecting, the very first detectives, and I believe they were French, I could be wrong about that, but the very first people who wrote the book on being a detective came up with one simple universal fact about a crime scene.
You've got 10 minutes.
The perpetrator will leave something of themselves at the crime scene, and they will take something of the crime scene with them. And if you can make that link, you solve the crime. And that is a universal fact when it comes to crime scenes. So if you wash everything away, makes it a bit tricky.
Yeah, then you've only got the bit that the murderer is carrying away. 2 months later, on May 9, 1989, 84-year-old widow Lady Winifreda Ashton walked down Military Road, the same road on which Mrs. Mitchell Hill was attacked, towards home late that afternoon. She was heading to nearby Raglan Street, where she lived, after playing bingo at Mossman RSL for the afternoon.
Ah, bingo.
Old lady's pastime. My grandma plays bingo.
Does she still play bingo?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I used to accompany my grandmother every now and again to the RSL club to play bingo. One day, I won bingo. I won, I think it was about $35.
And I'm pretty sure every woman there was looking to stab you.
Well, I thought I was rich, of course. So I walk into the toy store with a handful of dollars. I'm like, I am so going to buy everything in this store. And I think after I'd started collecting maybe like 5 or 6 boxes, Mum had to explain to me how much money I actually had. Oh. So I think she wanted to let the fantasy run its course until I had about $300 worth of Transformers. But I still walked home with 2 Transformers that day. So 2 is better than 1, and 1 is better than none.
Especially when you actually didn't have to pay for any of it.
Absolutely.
In the reality way. Again, Lady Ashton made it into the foyer of her apartment building before someone hit her over the head with a hammer.
That's bloody brazen to, like...
Middle of the afternoon.
It's the middle of the afternoon.
It's 4 p.m.
Yeah. Now people like to think that, you know, the world starts after 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It doesn't. You know, 3:30 p.m., you're seeing people coming and going, kids are coming home. There's more traffic on the street than normal. It's actually a really, really bad time to commit a murder. But the fact that he is doing it in the foyer, like it's not even break and enter. It's like
stalk and kill.
It's such a quick opportunistic thing that I find it. Yeah, it's incredibly brazen. Absolutely.
He dragged her into a rubbish bin alcove, continuing his assault by smashing her head into the pavement.
At one stage, she almost had me until I fell on top of her and repeatedly bashed her head against the concrete.
And that's from Poor Kids Never to Be Released. When she was unconscious, he removed her pantyhose and strangled her. He gathered up her shoes and her walking stick and laid them at the woman's feet. Then he left with her purse containing about $100.
I find this very, very interesting for 2 reasons. One, the direct comparison to the Boston Strangler. Another infamous American case. Now, the Boston Strangler, pretty much the exact same thing. Targeted elderly victims.
Do you know what age, era he was operating in?
I believe it was around the 70s, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You'd have to look it up. So, yeah, exactly the same MO, strangling with the pantyhose, and then ritual afterwards. So the ritual... in the Boston Strangler case was, unfortunately, he displayed his victims in such a way that their genitalia would be very obvious to the first person who came across the crime scene. You know, obviously, there are some psychosexual issues there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the Boston Strangler. Now, the Granny Killer that we're talking about today also has a ritual. So the pantyhose... could be seen as opportunistic, but I don't think that that will be the case as we continue on in this story. The other thing is the resetting of the victim's possessions. And he does this every single time.
From here on out anyway, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think he's saying when he does this?
I'm sorry, all I wanted was your money, so I'm just going to leave all your stuff here so you can prove that I didn't actually take anything else. But this is my purse now.
I don't think so.
That's my theory.
perfectly valid theory. I think that what he's doing in this case is taking ownership over the person, and there may even be a little bit of remorse here. It's almost like death has occurred, but he's resetting the victim almost as if, like, you know, the walking stick gets positioned very purposefully. The body is repositioned very purposely. It's almost as if he's saying, like, it's almost as like he's negating the violence of his crimes by cleaning up the signs of struggle.
If you want to go that way, sure.
Yeah, but that's how I sort of see his ritual. Most serial killers have some sort of ritual. You know, Ramirez used to pray to Satan before he'd go out and do his crazy bullshit. Ivan Milat, part of his ritual was using the bodies as target practice. The Snowtown Boys, that was torture before the murder. Every serial killer has some sort of little ritual. And, you know, psychologists can read into that all day.
In about 30 years' time, serial killers that would like to use this specific MO will be out of luck because women stopped wearing pantyhose around about the 1980s. So people of my generation, younger and maybe a little bit older, wouldn't be wearing pantyhose. He'd have to supply his own.
What's the difference? He would. What's the difference between pantyhose and stockings?
They're the same thing.
Okay, so what are the things that we sell at work then?
The only time women will wear them is if they're mandated in an office space or if they have a particular liking for them. Most women, like me, like most of the girls I hang out with, we point blank refuse to wear that shit. It's hot and it's sticky and all it does is cause runs in it and they're horrible. You can only wear them twice. Fuck that shit. Rather wear like tights.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen you wear stockings of any kind.
I've worn fishnets as part of costumes. That's about it. Black Canary has fishnet stockings in her costume.
Comic book costumes, folks.
Yes. Before anybody jumps on that shit. Police found Lady Ashton's body lying face down in the bin alcove, a pool of blood drying around her head. The hose around her neck was pulled so tightly that it had cut through the skin in some places, and there was a thin trickle of blood from the corner of her mouth. She had a small cut on her cheek with the mark of a hammer nearby. Her diamond wedding band was still present on her hand.
This is a big deal for a lot of reasons. So, you know, first you want to speculate about robbery. Obviously, there's a diamond ring sitting there and it's untouched. The stealing of the person's possession has nothing to do with any monetary gain.
Or if it is, it's fast monetary, as in straight up cash, rather than I have to then deal with pawning this shit.
It's about having the possession. This is the trophy. A lot of serial killers like to keep little trophies. That, you know, Ted Bundy kept the heads. In this case,
Ted Bundy or dude with glasses. Can't remember his name.
You thinking Kemper?
No, the other one, the creepy one with the boys, and he had all the heads, and he tried to put it in the oven and dry him out, and all he did was crumble.
Oh, yes. You're talking about Jeffrey Dahmer.
Jeremy. Yes, Jeffrey Dahmer.
Jeffrey Dahmer, yes. He kept the skulls and made a little throne. Isn't it wonderful what people get up to, ladies and gentlemen?
There is too much of this shit in my brain.
Yeah, way too much in mine too. But it's important to understand. It's important to discuss these things. And it's important to understand these people. There are serial killers among us, and there is no reason that we can't understand them. And then that way, you know, a little bit of knowledge is power. If you feel suspect about someone because of something you've listened to, well, then, you know, you can go a long way to preventing anything nasty happening to you. But yeah, you know, in this case, it's really giving a look into his psychology. Taking of the purse is a big deal. Hammer mark suggests that he's carrying around a weapon with him.
Mm-hmm.
And ignoring the diamond gives further weight to my theory that, yeah, that this dude is just taking a trophy.
A post-mortem examination was carried out in the hope of finding some clue as to who was responsible for this series of bashings. Due in part to Mrs. Ashton's high profile, she was the widow of Impressionist painter Sir John Ashton.
Have you ever heard of John Ashton or seen his work?
I'm not an artsy type of person. I don't know Impressionism from postmodernism.
Postmodernism is...
It's a banana taped to a wall. That's as much as I know. It's been a long time since Year 10 art history.
I think postmodernism is a bit more surreal because...
Banana taped to a wall or just a plain white canvas.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Pollock.
No, Pollock did the blue poles, didn't he?
No, Pollock did the paint splats everywhere. Ah. That's the joke in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes, that's, yeah, it looks like, yep, I remember.
I've been watching a lot of Marvel.
Whereas,
Jackson Pollock.
Impressionism Is that like looking at Sank in the real world and then reinterpreting it on canvas?
No clue.
We should probably not focus too much on this. You all have Google. Go check it out. But he was a famous artist, though.
Well, he was a sir.
Yep.
So he was automatically one of the peerage, which is
so
why...
So if you're a sir, that means you had to be knighted by the queen, yes. Correct?
Which makes yep. your wife Lady Ashton.
Old Liz.
Yes. Because of their status, more police resources were devoted to solving this particular crime.
Isn't that always the way when the rich person gets... You want the cops on your back? This is how you do it.
Media personality.
An affluent woman or a small girl?
Or someone who's really, really rich.
That is the most... That's the easiest way to actually get police to give a shit about what's going on. If you're a prostitute... if you're a member of the LGBT community, if you're just a regular 35-year-old white dude,
backpacker,
chances are you may end up on a big pile at the bottom of an even bigger pile.
For any reference, see any of our other episodes where the bodies just pile and pile and pile.
Yeah, I mean, the colloquialism is the less dead, and that specifically...
The lesser dead.
Yeah, and that specifically applies to people within minority groups and sex workers, things like that. And it's true, you know, there is sort of... there are certain victims that get people's attention. The fact that the elderly were being targeted as well... is also another reason why there was a lot of attention put to this.
With three women now on the list of victims, the police began to suspect that there was a serial killer at work. All three elderly women were attacked in the same suburb before being robbed of their handbags. The assailant's need to kill rose again 2 weeks after the attack. On November 2nd, Dorothy Benek walked down a street off Lowndesville Road, Lane Cove, carrying her groceries.
This is a pretty quick, I'd almost go so far as, like, this dude's evolution of his serial killer career, if I could use such a term to describe it, is actually really quick. He has a very quick ramping up process, he escalates extremely quickly, and his cooling off between murders is only 2 weeks, which is pretty crazy. That's closer to more of a berserker mode.
Where they always ramp up where they get closer and closer. Just look at the Bernies.
Yeah, but the cooldown is so small. That's what I'm like, that 2 week cooldown period, this person wanted to murder again. You know, they couldn't help themselves.
A car passing by her stopped and the occupant pulled over to offer the woman assistance in carrying her bags. She accepted, inviting him home for a cup of tea as a thank you.
Standard old lady thank you.
Especially in the 80s.
Now, can I tell a very quick story about my best old lady thank you, though?
I think I know this one. Go for it.
No, not that one. I was nearly sexually assaulted by an old lady when I was delivering stuff. Not that thank you. That wasn't a good thank you. The sexually assaulted may be too strong a words, but it definitely felt very awkward. The best thank you I got is we delivered something heavy though. I think it was a fridge or something like that. The old lady that we delivered it to gave us $20 each to go buy lunch.
That's nice.
And I thought that was very lovely of her.
The man left the home without incident and on his way back down the laneway to the main street. While walking down the laneway, the man who had just assisted Mrs. Benek closed past 85-year-old Margaret Pahod, who was also on her way home with her groceries. This time, he didn't hesitate. He hit the woman from behind, smacking her on the head with a blunt instrument, probably a hammer. When she collapsed, he hit her on the side of the head again. He rearranged her clothes, shoes, and walking stick, took her handbag, and left.
See what I mean? Once again, the ritual is occurring. Like, this is almost a compulsion where he has to reorganize everything before he can leave the crime scene. I wonder if maybe it was his signature. Maybe he's trying to get across that these crimes are connected.
It's definitely growing into one anyway.
Now, you may wonder, why would he skip the perfect opportunity he'd been let into someone's home and yet he didn't kill that person, walks out the door and then kills another person? Well, the answer is pretty simple. It's called power and control. More often than not, a lot of serial killers, Son of Sam is a great example of this, fantasize about assisting and then hurting very, very quickly. They do that because they want to feel like God. They have control over the situation, not the other person. Today, I could go and rescue you. Tomorrow, I could slit your throat. That's what's happening right now. It's not weird. It's not out of behavior. It doesn't demonstrate that they have control over themselves. What's going on is he's walking this person into her home and is sitting there and going, you know, aren't I a good person?
I am so benevolent.
I helped this elderly lady. I am very, very good, and I'm not going to kill her because I am God and I have power to kill and to save, and today I decide to save. 2 minutes later, of course, he walks down the laneway and kills another person.
Within a few minutes, the woman was discovered by a young schoolgirl who thought the body was just a pile of clothes dumped in the laneway.
Also, these poor school kids, this is the third school kid that's discovered a body.
Yep. Again, neighbours washed down the scene before police arrived and destroyed any evidence.
I want to say that this is the last time this happens, but it isn't. It keeps happening. People keep washing down the crime scene again and again and again and again. It's devastating, Holly. They were destroying evidence every time.
Well, they just assume she fell and hit herself in the head with a hammer.
God, it's so silly. Like, yeah, just don't wash crime scenes. Don't do it.
The killer rummaged through Mrs. Parhood's purse on the grounds of a nearby golf club, leaving the remains on the green, pocketing the $300 he'd taken from the handbag.
Exhausted from the lack of sleep by the end of the day, Detective Inspector Mike Hagen called into the Pennant Hills Police Station on his way home to answer an urgent message on his beeper. He dialed Task Force Headquarters. His knees sagged as he was told they had yet another body, another pantyhose strangling.
And that came from Never to Be Released.
I listened to a couple of interviews that he did, specifically for Forensic Files. I think it's a TV show produced by the Nine Network here in Australia. And he's like, we'd been working our asses off. I was headed home with the plan to have one day off, get some rest, and hit it again with fresh eyes, which is really important. Like, I know that people think that detectives should just sit there and go through it and go, you need that time to step away from the subject matter, come back to it. And just like a jigsaw puzzle, sometimes you can see something that you've been overlooking because you've been too focused on solving the problem. So I never, ever bemoan any police officer needing to take some time so that they can regroup and hit it again. And he's like, I just gotten in my driveway. Beeper went off. If you don't know what a beeper is, those were fun.
Congratulations
little things
on being young.
Yeah, there were little things in the 90s where you could call it and it would send a little alert to say you need to call this person back at this number.
Also in the 2000s, because it's in Bruce Almighty.
Yes. So beepers still existed for quite some time. You wouldn't have one today. Everyone's got a mobile that's a mini computer that does everything for you.
Send you the message anyway. Yeah. You don't need to ring someone for it.
And he was just like, just got back in his car and drove back to the station.
The attack on Mrs. Parhood was on November 2nd. On November 3rd, 81-year-old Olive Cleveland sat on a bench outside the Wesley Gardens retirement village in Belrose, enjoying the sun, when a man approached her and struck up a conversation. The man made her a little bit uncomfortable, so she got up and walked towards the main building. The man grabbed her from behind and forced her down a ramp into a secluded side lane, where he beat her and smashed her head into the concrete before he removed her pantyhose and strangled her with it. Again, the man rearranged his victim's clothing, shoes, and walking stick, then left, taking $60 from her handbag. Once again, the woman's injuries were initially attributed to a fall.
Don't say it.
And the scene was washed down with no eyewitnesses to testify otherwise.
This is not the last one.
We have a quote here again for you to read.
Hagen later said, I just can't explain my feelings that night. To have just come home from a murder and to be told there's another one, it's terrible. We'd had two serial murders within 24 hours. We'd never heard of such a thing before. Now, can I just ask Holly just quickly, this particular area of Sydney, is this like an affluent area, the North Shore, or is
anything
it just
north of Sydney Harbour is considered a rich man territory?
Okay. Right.
So it's literally north of the harbour. So, yeah, Bondi, North Shore, Cronulla, it's all considered rich person territory.
Right. So as soon as you go across that bridge, you go from the Poories to the Richies.
Yep.
Right. And you lived in with the Poories.
Oh, we lived in those, out in the sticks. We were poor as fuck. The police understood the nature of the crimes immediately, understanding them to be serial in nature.
And this was only a new thing. Serial, the understanding of serial crime was only relatively new. We're talking 1980s Mindhunter.
We're talking 1974, according to the chapter in Weed Crap 1 that I edited today.
Oh, very good. Wait, you re-edited a chapter?
Well, that was the audiobook chapter that I was editing.
Right. I'm like, what?
Yeah, you said 1974, so I'm going to hold you to that and bring that back up.
No, it would be true then, 1974 then. Yeah, it was only still a relatively new thing. I mean, like even the biggest serial killers in Australia were yet to even start killing or had yet to be caught killing. Like Ivan Milat
was already stealing people off the highway at this point.
But he'd had a massive cooling off period when he was over in New Zealand.
Onions would be attacked, I think, within a week of this.
Yeah. So
there you go.
They're only just like serial crime in Australia is only just starting to be acknowledged.
The state government doubled its initial reward for the murders from $100,000 to $200,000. Now, Matthew, nowadays that could pay off our mortgage. In 2020, it was worth $430,000.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of money. You're killing rich old ladies.
Mm-hmm.
You go.
Especially once you knock off a lady.
Yeah.
Like a lady, you know, lady.
And especially the government at the time. That's their voting demographic, man. And they're feeling unsafe in a rich suburb. They don't. You
1989,
know.
Keating. What side was he on?
That is left wing.
Okay.
That's so left wing Labor. Yeah.
We have a quote here from the Canberra Times.
The Minister for Police, Ted Pickering, approved two more rewards of $50,000 yesterday on top of the present two of $50,000 for information on the deaths of Gwendolyn Mitchell-Hill, 82, and Lady Winifreda Ashton, 84.
So it's not really doubling it. It's just like, well, we've now got four victims, so here's four lots of $50,000.
It's very rare that monetary rewards actually pay off. I honestly think it's more of like, I would love to talk to a police officer and actually ask them why they do this. But I would imagine that it's more likely that you're hoping that maybe someone close to the culprit will come forward and accidentally like implicate themselves or accidentally implicate the person or.
I don't think it's an accident if you're ringing up going, hey, yeah. I've got a tip for you.
Yeah. I want that 20 grand. Send it my way. I would be very curious as to if it's very effective because this happens all the time. Like people offer huge substantial rewards and nothing ever comes of it.
Do you know of someone who has received a reward for this kind of stuff? Yeah, does it actually happen?
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. Like what the current outstanding amount on Mr. Krull is a quarter of a mil?
Maybe a bit more.
Maybe a bit more, yeah. So
it's a lot.
And he's never been caught, so.
Not even close.
Yeah. If you're listening, Mr. Krull, I will catch
you. We're not even vaguely onto you. Just keep.
I'll catch you.
Laying low, man.
I'll get you.
The perpetrator waited for a few weeks before making his next move. On November 23rd, 93-year-old Muriel Falconer was returning home from her shopping when she walked past the Buena Vista Hotel in Mossman, heading for Muston Road.
Can I say a distant relative of hers was most likely a Falconer?
Quite possibly.
I would say so.
A married one. The woman was partially deaf and blind. Sadly, this made her an easy target.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing to talk about as well is just the nature of the vulnerability of the people. You're not expecting much of a fight, which also says a lot about the perpetrator. Unfortunately, the killing of elderly women happens a lot more than people think. And the reason that it happens is because they make very easy targets.
Well, even thinking into my family, the difference between my 80-year-old grandmother and my 93-year-old great-grandmother when she died, there's a lot of difference. You'd aim for the 93-year-old before you attack the 80-year-old.
There was also a very funny viral video that went around. Someone tried to break into a grandma's house, but she was a bodybuilder.
She beat the shit out of him.
She did. She got, like, she
She's
beat
an American.
Him. She beat him so severely that when the police rocked up, he confessed and asked them to protect him.
Yep.
Because I think she broke ribs, she fractured his nose. Like,
I've watched the clip of her explaining what she did. She beat the shit out of him with a chair, then she smacked him in the face, she sat on him.
Yeah, yeah, she really hurt
him. Stomped him.
Champion for doing it too. And I'm sure he learned a valuable lesson. Don't beat up old ladies because sometimes they can kick your ass.
Or at least vet the house you're breaking into a lot better. The murderer waited for Falconer to open her front door before he leapt into action, grabbing her mouth to keep her quiet before he hit her on the head with his hammer, repeatedly around the neck and head. When the woman fell to the floor, he tried removing her pantyhose. As he did so, Falconer regained consciousness and cried out for help. In response, the man panicked and hit her again and again until she passed out. He then used her underwear to strangle her. The man shut the front door for privacy, then went through her purse and her house for money. He rearranged her shoes near her body and left with his hammer and $100. The body was discovered the following afternoon when a neighbor entered the house using a spare key. Because this attack took place within the house, the scene was undisturbed, not washed down, Matthew, you'll be glad to hear.
Thank Christ.
And the police were able to collect evidence, including bloody footprints. A different neighbor described seeing a middle-aged, portly, grey-haired man near the house the day before, and a new identikit was created.
Yeah, we probably didn't talk about this, but we should probably hit on it just briefly.
Until this point.
Until this point, the key suspect were kids with skateboards.
Because it's the 80s, 90s. Yeah.
So what had happened is an elderly gentleman had actually been attacked by a kid with a skateboard and he was robbed. So they were like, okay, it's a kid. And then the police, in my opinion, they were actually, like, they were on the right track. They turned around and said, well, these attacks are constantly happening at 3:30. Who's out and about at 3:30? Kids, teenagers. So they assumed that it was actually a school kid that was murdering these people and stealing their money with just a financial gain.
If you've read, if you've listened to our Sydney Cliff Murders episode, you know that a pack of teenagers are one of the most deadly and dangerous creatures in the fucking planet.
So up until that point, the composite image was a teenage boy. Then when this happened and they were actually able to, for the first time, ID their suspect and come up with at least a composite of what they thought he looked like, the lead detective, Hagen, was like, oh shit, it's a middle-aged man. It's the perfect cover because they're not going to suspect him. And for weeks and weeks and weeks, they've been telling the elderly ladies, watch out for a teenage killer.
Mm-hmm. And we have a quote here from the Canberra Times.
Police are anxious to talk to anyone who may have seen Mrs. Falconer walking to her home on Thursday when she was wearing a brown dress, carrying a grey striped shopping bag and using a walking stick. Detective Inspector Hagen said that when her body had been discovered on Friday, she had been wearing a red and pink cardigan and a multicoloured striped long-sleeved dress.
By Christmas, the reward had jumped again, this time to $250,000, reflecting the extra victim on the list. In 2020, $542,000.
Just over $500,000.
Enough to buy one bedroom in a house in Sydney.
Yep.
Nowadays.
They just announced that the median price of Sydney has jumped to $1.3 million.
Yeah, that's why I said you could buy one bedroom. Yep. Not a one-bedroom house, one bedroom.
Yeah, that's why there's going to be a horrendous economic housing collapse here in Australia very, very soon. And everyone who owns property like us are about to see the value of that property halved.
I mean, we're in Canberra. Nothing ever changes around here.
It's coming. You feel it though, don't you? Like the
I'm not going to sell anytime in the next 30 years, so I don't really care.
Yeah, it's like when inflation in housing prices doesn't keep pace with inflation in wages, something's going to give.
1990 dawned in Sydney and the man remained at large, though the focus was starting to narrow in on suspects. Those suspects were put aside when another incident was brought to the police attention.
Police believe a serial killer could be responsible because of the similarities in the attacks, which all occurred during daylight on the North Shore and involved a blunt weapon. Although the crimes are similar, police are looking for a number of suspects because of diverging descriptions of people near the scenes. Police are still hoping to find a man in his late 20s seen carrying a 1 meter length of wood and other items in the vicinity of Friday's murder.
And again, that came from the Canberra Times. On the 11th of January, 1990, at Greenwich Hotel in River Road, Greenwich, a man entered the hospital's palliative care ward, which held four elderly and ill women, including 82-year-old advanced cancer patient Daisy Roberts. The man, who was holding a clipboard and wearing a workman's uniform, asked if she was losing any body heat, then pulled up her nightgown and touched her in an indecent manner. Roberts panicked and called for help, upon which a nurse, Sister Pauline Davis, found the man standing in the ward. When confronted, he ran from the ward and the nurse was able to record his car's registration number and notified police. The hospital staff were able to identify and name the man as John Glover, as he was known from doing his pie rounds in the hospital. He'd been there that day for an appointment with the hospital administrator, Reg Cademan.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is where we will leave it for this week.
Mm-hmm. Dun, dun, dun.
Next episode, we're going to do a deep dive into Mr. John Wayne Glover, the prime suspect, and we're going to help put together some of the puzzle pieces. I think you're going to find it quite fascinating. I found it quite fascinating because the MO with John Glover and the MO, well, his name was John Wayne Glover. The MO between him and the Boston Strangler is nearly identical. And we're going to go into that a little bit more with the next episode and the conclusion to the Granny Killer. Bum, bum, bum.
Lock your doors at night, kids.
Absolutely.
Sorry, old ladies.
And kids and everyone. And lock your door right now. Lock it. Do it now.
Did you lock ours?
Probably not, actually, now that I think about it. Well, just before we leave you, don't forget, if you want to keep the conversation going, maybe you know something about the world of serial killers or rewards, as Holly mentioned earlier. Do you know anyone who's received a monetary reward for dobbing someone in? We'd love to hear from you. Keep the
It's not dobbing someone in if they're criminals.
Telling on them, implicating them.
Implicating is probably a better... Dobbing implies that you're the one that fucked up. Yeah,
fair enough, fair enough. I agree and withdraw my dobbing statement. Thanks for dobbing me in.
I dob you into the listeners all the time. Multiple times an episode.
You can find us on Facebook, We're Crap in Australia. You can also find us under the same name for Instagram, and you can find me hanging around on Twitter. My handle is at weirdcrapinaus. If you would like to support what we do here at Weird Crap in Australia and, you know, help us continue on with our research and buying research materials and digital storage and all that fun stuff, which all unfortunately cost money, you can do so by heading to our Patreon page. Just type in weirdcrapinaustralia.com. That'll take you straight to the page. And for as little as $5 USD a month, you get the mainline episodes completely ad-free. We all hate ads and we like ad-free stuff. That's the way to do it. You can also get yourself a bonus minisode, which we release every week, and a chapter from our upcoming audiobook. You get to have it first, which is very exciting. You also get to participate in polls where we ask you what you would like our next episodes to be. Spoiler alert, currently the leader for one of our future episodes is on the Kookaburra.
Actually, no, it changed.
Oh, what did it change to?
The Blue Ringed Octopus.
Ooh, that's quite a fun one too.
I looked on and it went from like 40% voting for the Kookaburra and then now down to 28%.
Oh, well, there you go. If you would like to change that poll, well, you better get in quick.
It's actually too late, but way next month's poll late. Is open.
There'll be another poll on the way. If you'd like to get involved in helping us to produce the show, which is essentially what you're doing, $5 USD a month will get you there. And if you'd just like to be involved in the poll, that's only $1 USD a month. So for the price of the coffee, we will entertain you all week.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, pretty good deal. You can also support us by grabbing some of our merch. Grab a Weird Crap in Australia t-shirt from our Redbubble store, weirdcrapinaus.redbubble.com. You can also get coasters for the beer room, mats for the bathroom, and curtains the for curtains. The shower. You can get everything from our Redbubble store, weirdcrapinaus.redbubble.com, and buy a book. Weird Crap in Australia Volume 1 and 2. We have two books. And they're actually quite substantial. You could kill a serial killer if you hit them with the book.
I reformatted volume one, so it's not quite as thick, but it's still pretty heavy.
You can
hold volume two with it and make it twice as heavy.
You can just throw books at possible intruders and also learn something. It's not just what we say on the podcast just turned into a book. There's actual, you know, follow-up and things like that. And we're pretty proud, especially of volume two, which does contain some correspondence with family members who were involved with one of our cases. So if you want those extra bits and pieces, don't forget you can pick up volume one and two from Amazon.com and you can grab that on the Kindle. That's the digital edition. You can get it print on demand from Lulu.com and you can get it from our great mates at Impact Comics who are now in stock.
Yay, we dropped them off last week.
We finally got the stock for them. So that's there. So that's great. So just shoot them an email, info@impactcomics.com.au. You can also order through the website. You can give them a call and they do Australia-wide shipping. Weird Crap in Australia books. The only retail store is Impact Comics. So go grab those and grab them quick because, you know, being able to order and get it to the store seems to be really tough at the moment. So they've got they've got three sets at the moment of volume one and two. So make sure you rush down there and grab those and let them know that we sent you. Otherwise, Holly, that's all I got, I think. I think I covered everything I needed to cover. And as is customary, before you fall asleep in your seat, give us some final words of wisdom.
I've actually got two. Number one, by this point in time, we've probably crossed 400,000 listens. So high five to everyone who's listened. Number two, I wanted to find out what you think your serial killer moniker would be.
Mine?
Yeah.
Like what my nickname would be?
Yeah, what the press would probably give you.
Oh dear, you've put me on the spot now. And this
think,
is
Matthew,
like
think.
This is like the end. I would imagine that my serial killer moniker, I think I would like it to be something very scary and disturbing, you know, like
the Canberra Carver or something like that.
Oh, the Canberra Carver. That'd actually be more you because you're the butcher. But yeah, you know, I'd like saying it to be really sinister, but I know that if I were to be a serial killer, the press would come up with like the...
I'd write in to try and make it as silly and as childish as I possibly could get.
The weepy sook killer or, you know, the French dandy killer or, you know, it'd be something really it'd be really crap, you know, so I'd be really bummed out. I definitely wouldn't be called like get a good name like a Zodiac killer or the Night Stalker. Or I'd get some real shit.
You'd have to come up with your own if you wanted something like that, I think.
I'd have to leave clues, and I think if you have to leave clues and you're sort of defeating the purpose of the whole thing.
It's like explaining the joke to someone.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know it's the Riddler because he can't help himself. He's got to leave fucking riddles everywhere, which is really obnoxious. You know, so I'd have to be like, and don't forget to refer to me as the Canberra Carver. Off I go into the night. Ha ha. And that's just wanky. It's just really wanky.
So wanky.
Yeah. What about you guys? What would your serial killer moniker be? I will leave you with that thought. Thanks so much for joining us for another episode into the world of the weird, the strange, and the Australian. And we will see you back again for more Weird Crap in Australia next week for the conclusion of The Granny Killer. Bye for now.
See you later.
The Weird Crap in Australia podcast is hosted and produced by Holly and Matthew Soule. Our editor is Blake Kell. Weird Crap in Australia is a production of The Modern Meltdown.